I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors, Producers Wealth. If you're interested to set up your infinite banking policy correctly and have access to a coach that will help you use your infinite banking strategy to grow your business and your investment portfolio, and having your capital work in more than one place simultaneously, and protect your capital from market downturns, taxes, predators, and creditors, you can watch a presentation of exactly how you can do this at yourownbankingsystem.com. That's yourownbankingsystem.com. Welcome to the Cashflow Ninja, the podcast sharing how to create and grow income streams and manage, multiply, and protect your wealth in the new economy. Are you tired of trading your time for money? Do you desire freedom today instead of retirement in 10, 20, or 30 years? I'm MC Lobsher, and this is the Cashflow Ninja. This is Cashflow Ninja. I'm MC Lobsher. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Cashflow Ninja podcast. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at cashflowninja.com. That's cashflowninja.com. And don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at cashflowninja.com/subscribe. I've got a fantastic show for you today. I'm joined by Eugene Schatzman. Eugene is a business owner and an investor. Eugene has incredible insights with regards to business strategy. I've learned a lot from him. And in our conversation today, he's going to share the five pillars of how to grow your business in a recession. Eugene, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, MC. I'm a big fan, and I appreciate what you're doing for all the business owners out there.
No, I appreciate you, and I've been looking forward to this conversation. We've gotten to know each other over the past couple of years or so, and I've always appreciated our conversations. So really excited about today. But for listeners and for viewers that are not familiar with you and what you do, could you please share a little bit about your background and journey with them?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, at this current moment, I run a marketing company called National Strategic Group. We're based in Cleveland, Ohio, but we have clients all over the country, in some cases globally. The reality is that, you know, while we have 100 marketers and kind of subject matter experts who work for us, the one thing that has always kind of been a big focus of mine is strategy. And in fact, you know, one of the reasons why I thought our conversation would be so relevant today is that, you know, my company, National Strategic, was started in the midst of the 2008-2009 recession. In fact, it was kind of one of the driving purposes for the company was to help identify people who are still spending money on marketing, but might be squandering some opportunity. So that's where, you know, I kind of saw the vision and saw the opportunity to say, you know, people need a really efficient way to generate demand, to market their services, to build their brand. But more importantly, all of those things came together with a strategy and kind of that whole idea of being a strategy company first. We didn't offer any of the services that we offer now, which is like websites, search engine optimization, reputation management, you know, digital marketing, kind of all aspects of digital marketing ads, and just any kind of demand generation that we do for our clients. At the time, we were just a strategy company, MC, and where I started, and this is kind of where I get in seeing things full circle, is helping businesses develop strategies that ultimately help them grow during a time of economic uncertainty, rather than kind of scale back and shrink and kind of just wait for the storm to pass.
When you talk about strategy and business strategy in particular, what is your approach and your philosophical approach to a business strategy?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question, because I think there's been a lot of great books written on strategy, and there's a lot of, you know, phenomenal professors who teach strategy in really excellent business schools. What I've tried to do is make strategy something that is a little bit less like a binder that sits on your desk that collects dust, and more of a tactile, mobile thing that can really evolve with you as different forces in the marketplace evolve. So we believe there's six parts to the strategy definition. It's kind of taken me a decade to get, you know, super clear on this, but those six parts are the business leverage points. So the things that make you in your business absolutely unique. your competitive analysis or competitive advantage, meaning, you know, so when you think about your unique things, is anybody else saying that they have those same unique things that you compete with? You know, I once worked with a LASIK surgeon in Atlanta who told me that, you know, he has the best technology in the area. And that might be true. But, you know, when you go do the competitive analysis, there's three other guys who do the same thing or who do something similar. And they say they have the best technology. If you look at their websites, well, then one of them does have the best technology, probably objectively. But in the eye of a consumer, you're all lying. Right. Yeah. So then so there's leverage points, competitive analysis, market demand. So like the things that you do really, really well and the things that are really your leverage points, how much market demand is there for those particular elements? And over the last few, I would say over the last decade, there's been so many tools that have come forward to the marketplace where we can actually measure demand, like precision. With precision, I can tell you how many times did someone raise their hand and say, I need services that you offer, MC, in a geographic area that you serve. So market demand kind of with precision on that. Number four would be business goals. And this is where I think most people say, well, the strategy is just kind of understanding what someone's goals are and then having an implementation plan to get there. And I think those are key parts, but you can't do that without understanding what makes someone different, how that stacks up against the competition, the market demand. And then you start looking at someone's business goals. And frequently those goals are just like growth, right? Like I want to grow 20% of my business. I want to grow 100% of my business. But you have to take that growth and break it down and kind of relay that back to leverage points and what makes you unique. And then from there, you can say, okay, the other two pieces of the strategy cube, as I call it, is your growth plan. And then which is all the tools you're going to use to actually help you grow. And then the systems, the KPIs, the actual numbers you're going to use to measure success. And so I just gave you six pieces of the strategy piece. Well, that's a cube. Imagine it's a Rubik's cube. And imagine that Rubik's cube is always shifting and is always changing. You have to, as one side changes, you have to move the other sides to figure everything out. And so that's kind of how I teach my team to look at strategy when they work with their clients, and how I teach, you know, our clients to think about strategy when they think about growing their business.
I really appreciate the part where you start with a strategy, which is the golf swing. And then eventually, as you go down that list that you just shared, then you get to the tools and then you build systems,
right,
which to use that tool then that produces predictable results, right?
That's exactly it. And then everything has to be able to evolve and be able to make a turn. The second the market shifts, you have to be able to, your strategy can't be stagnant. You've got to be able to change. A competitor does something different, you've got to be able to adapt.
Right. And I really like that, because you can change the first couple of points, leverage, competitive advantage, the demand that's out there, the goals. Those are things that are changing in a changing environment. And then adjustments can be made with the tools and the systems. I love how you just broke that down. And we sure are in a very dynamic environment right now. You know, you have to understand your environment in which you operate as a business owner and as an investor during this time. You know, ton of uncertainty, right? There is massive changes happening, some of them visible, some of them invisible. It's happening at a speed and a rate that we haven't quite seen before. And this produces a lot of disruption in many different industries, in every single industry. And then also it manifests itself by producing a kind of a chaotic environment, right?
Yep.
In society and also out in the marketplace. What are some of the things that you're seeing in the in your business, and then some of the businesses, which is very focused on in the medical side? What are you seeing in the current economy right now?
Well, MC, the reason I went into marketing is because I wanted to study consumer behavior, right? The psychology and economics working together kind of to form this, to kind of help inform how it is that consumers make decisions in today's marketplace has always fascinated me. It's fascinated me for, the better part of the last two decades. And what's interesting is that following what consumers are doing today is kind of what's creating this playbook in my mind of like, here's what you do when consumers are really clueless as to what to do. And, you know, we can look at the facts as part of the situation. And the facts are pretty straightforward. Consumers are spending more money on the same things this year than they did last year. And I read in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago that I think that number is somewhere between $400 and $500 and the average family has to spend per month in order to buy the same basket of goods that they did at this time last year. So, okay, so they have maybe less disposable income. And then, you know, the market is constantly swinging. The volatility in the market is kind of communicating this feeling of uncertainty. I'm not easily confident like I was in the past that, you know, I just put money into this vessel and then it grows, or that I have wealth, or that I will have wealth in the future. I think consumers are kind of, you know, they're uncertain, right? They're not certain with what's happening today. Yep. I think that, you know, in the world of kind of the geopolitical uncertainty as it stands right now, I think that kind of continues to add. We hear about kind of instability, and then just kind of helps pile on to the whole concept of instability. And then, you know, all of the consumer confidence studies are showing us that consumers feel less certain about where the country, where the economy, where things are headed now than they have in many, many years. You know, I saw one study, I think it was either the University of Michigan study or the Wall Street Journal study, that said that it was this summer we were at our lowest point in history ever since these polls were created in terms of consumer confidence, which is, yep, you know, not great for anybody who counts on consumers to make decisions. And we have to remember that even if we serve business owners, those business owners are consumers. So at the end of the day, I think that lack of certainty does two things. It creates an environment where everyone is kind of trying to navigate the chaos. And number two is it creates kind of a unique set of opportunities for business owners that know how to capitalize on them.
Yeah, I think that's very well as summarized. I actually had a conversation with someone, and the comment was, well, you know, after this next election in the midterms, there'll be more clarity and more certainty. And I said, nothing's going to change because that doesn't drive the markets, right? It's all these other things that's happening economically that manifest itself, you know, in some ways politically. Once that is done, you're going to be right where we are today. And it's interesting that, you know, we're now just past the midterms elections in the United States. And I know there's elections all around the world too. So our international listeners and viewers can relate to this. Nothing really has changed with regards to the certainty. There's still a massive amount of fear out there. There's still people that's very demoralized because they're essentially getting squeezed on both ends, right? They're seeing inflation. They're seeing the prices of everything that they consume going up. Their wages and their salaries might be stagnant. And now you're seeing, because there's such a supply destruction in a lot of industries because of many, many different factors, you're actually seeing like a deflationary effect happening in a lot of asset classes. So everything's getting more expensive. You're barely scraping by, you're getting squeezed, and you're seeing the value of the assets that you do have, whether it be your retirement plan, pensions in the UK, whether it be public or private, that just needed to be bailed out, the home that you're living in, those are all coming down. So yeah, none of these things have changed, you know, in the past 48 to 72 hours. So we're still existing in this environment that we have existed in for the past couple of months.
Exactly. No, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, even the word recession has been like politicized, right? Like we're in a recession by economic terms, we're not in a recession by the political terms, and maybe there'll be a light recession. It doesn't really matter. Like the semantics don't matter. What matters are the facts. And the facts are consumers have less money, consumers have less certainty, and you know, you need a playbook for that.
I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors. One of the wealth strategy secrets of the ultra wealthy is that they make more income and grow their net worth every year and legally pay less in taxes. They also grow their capital when markets go up, down, and sideways. They grow their capital in economies that grow and boom, and in economies that are in recessions and even depressions. If you are a high income earner and trying to figure out how to legally reduce your taxes while receiving cash flow and growing your capital, Pantheon Investments have a great opportunity right now. By leveraging Pantheon Investments' holistic wealth strategy and its exclusive relationships, you can access an opportunity right now in oil and gas. This opportunity will help W-2 earners to legally reduce taxes, generate cash flow, and grow their capital. This exclusive opportunity will also position you to be on the right side of rising oil and gas prices. This is a limited offering available to accredited investors only. To learn more, go to cashflowninja.com/Pantheon. That's cashflowninja.com/Pantheon. I actually pulled some data from the Federal Reserve's website where it shows the savings rate, is at a low. It's just plummeting.
Yep.
For Americans, and the debt is skyrocketing.
Yep.
It's interesting. At 2020, when all this currency creation happened, you actually had a spike in the savings rate.
Yep.
And lending was coming down a little bit because money, currency was just passed around all over the country. And then all of a sudden, when that started to run out, now it's, you know, savings rates plummeting. People are having to use debt and lines of credit just to essentially live at the same standard of living. So you could see that folks are pretty much squeezed. And, you know, back to the exit polls where they were polling a lot of people here in the United States that were voting. It was like 75% of people were unhappy about everything going on.
Yes, yes.
And I'm like, that's pretty much globally, right?
But let me share something with you, MC, because this is interesting. So as you mentioned, we work with a lot of medical practices and specifically in the elective medical space. Yeah. And what we're finding, and again, this is where there's this kind of like, I think that there's this clear, I'll call it a ray of hope or kind of this light at the end of the tunnel or this opportunity from our vantage point, is that there is, because people are unhappy, they will take steps and spend money to make themselves happier. Right. So, you know, there's this concept of self-care that's become very prevalent in our society. And, you know, we see, for example, we have a contingent of we'll call them aesthetic practices that help patients look better, feel more confident, that kind of thing. But sometimes that's through things like injectables, like, you know, Botox and such. Or sometimes that's through, you know, kind of surgical methods or whatever that looks like. And you know, that's just a contingent of some of the practices that we serve. But I think that market is in itself indicative and tells an interesting story, because what we're seeing is more people heading towards self-care at a time when they're unhappy about other things. So there's this kind of playbook that you can play out to say, you know, I can appeal to whoever has the dollar spending because of their current mental state, because of the way that they in particular are feeling today. We can use that information and kind of craft a business craft a message that appeals to the consumer in today's environment.
Yeah. And I think a lot of our business owners and investors that are experienced know that this is an incredible opportunity when economies are in a downward spiral and they go into recessions and even touch on a depression, which, again, that definition changes constantly. I think Doug Casey is the best one, where he just says essentially the standard of living for everyone goes down during a depression. I like that one. But essentially, there's massive, massive opportunities here. If we look at, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010, the incredible businesses that were created, yours was established during that time and just absolutely has been crushing it since then. So a massive opportunity. And the reason why I'm very excited to have you on the show is you actually have a strategy and you have five pillars of growth of how to grow your business during a recession to share with our listeners and our viewers. What are those five pillars?
Well, so let me take them one by one, and we kind of talk about them one at a time. And, you know, if people are taking notes, the first one, we'll call it grab share of voice. But I'll tell you a little story, which, you know, again, I believe that I completely agree with you that I think that how you react at a time like this, whether you're aggressive and you choose to and you choose to be really proactive, or you are reactive and you're kind of shrinking, and you'll get what your mindset is. And so part of the whole idea is that you have to have a mindset that says there is opportunity out there. There are people spending money. There are people making decisions and choices in the marketplace today. Maybe there's fewer of those people, but if you're intelligent about how you do things, as long as you recognize that what you did before has to be modified a little bit in order to make sure that you can support the current needs of today's consumer, then these five pillars will really work for you. So the first one is grab share of voice, and I'll tell you a little story. And, you know, it's like there's actually very few books that are written on recession marketing. One of the best ones that I found is, you know, something that Jay Abraham wrote, and he sold this book for like $1,000, where it just kind of compiles a few case studies or a few of his thoughts. But there's very few books that are written on recessionary marketing. So this is all research that my research team did. And, you know, we kind of compiled this playbook, so to speak, that we're teaching to our clients, and we're teaching to the people who we serve. But, you know, the first one, when we think about grabbing share of voice, the story starts with like 1991 recession, you know, had similar, you know, there was similar geopolitical instability. There were certain things that were rising in prices. And one of the biggest advertisers of the time on the radio waves, in its category, the biggest one in the food category, was McDonald's. And so at McDonald's decided at that point, they said, well, a recession is coming. You know, we can't really afford to spend this much money on market outreach. And so they cut their advertising, slashed it by more than half at the time. And what's interesting is that they watched their sales decline by over 28% throughout this recession and during that recession and immediately after. And, you know, you might say, well, that's okay, because they kind of weathered the storm. They did, you know, 28% everybody's sales decline in a recession. But what's interesting is that the second they made the decision to cut their spending in the food advertising category, there were a couple players that stepped in, and it was like Taco Bell and Pizza Hut both stepped in. And if you really want to entertain yourself, MC, like if you got like, I don't know, 10 minutes, before bed tonight or something, you want to entertain yourself, look up some ads from 1991 that were made by Taco Bell and Pizza Hut. It really, I mean, these are like the cheesiest, most poorly produced advertising elements of advertising. And I only know because I know we spent hundreds of hours, you know, slaving over like the perfect way to position something in an ad or in a marketing piece. And like, this looks like it was made in like 25 minutes. Like it's like, these are really, really cheesy ads. And so these guys flooded the airwaves with their like super cheesy, crappy ads. And Taco Bell sales grew 40% during the same time that McDonald's sales declined 28%. And Pizza Hut, they grew 61% in the same time that McDonald's sales declined 28%. In a recession, it was a huge opportunity for them because they did, my first principle is they grabbed share of voice. And one of the best, you know, in my mind, one of the best kind of indicators or one of the best quotes that I love about, you know, this particular principle is Henry Ford talked about how stopping advertising to save money is like stopping your watch to save time.
Right.
Right. And so for me, you know, the reason you want to grab share of voice at a time like this is because, first of all, the cost of advertising in a market like today starts dropping. You know, it goes from being a seller's market where Google and Facebook were just minting money hand over fist to now it's becoming more of a buyer's market. People are being more selective. And as a result, you know, the cost of advertising is reduced dramatically. We have a lot less noise. So your consumer went from seeing tens of thousands of messages per day. Now, you know, that number is smaller. And so you can do things to stand out. And then this whole idea of if you're the person who is still communicating with consumers and that message is relevant, which we'll talk about in a second, then you are communicating stability. You're communicating the value of your brand, of your offerings, while many other corporates are pulling out. And with, you know, people who have more of a scared mentality, which is tends to be larger corporations that are funded through investor dollars or are funded through borrowed money, they're the ones pulling back right now. And that's what I'm seeing in the marketplace. So all of my clients who compete with corporates are in a position to really explode during this time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I mean, I saw this in 2022 initially, because I mean, there was a shock factor, right, of March of 2020. And all of a sudden, there were folks that just froze and then went into retreat, essentially, and hunkered down and said, okay, we're stopping everything. We're cutting this. We're doing that. And then there were folks that were very courageous that understood that this was a massive opportunity. And exactly. They doubled down on advertising. And those companies, there's a couple in my industry too. I mean, they doubled and tripled basically in size that year, just because they saw the opportunity and they saw that everybody else was backing down and retreating and not doing it. And they jumped in and grabbed market share. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very, very.
Yeah. Well. So that's exactly right. I think this is so, but I don't advise people to just blindly throw money out into the advertising, you know, ecosphere. What we talk about, and this is principle number two, is testing everything. This is the time, right? This is the time where you can really you can really explode, but you cannot afford to squander opportunity. And so we teach people, you know, I think we're one of the only marketing companies that split tests web pages all the freaking time. Every single one of our clients, we're constantly split testing their websites. You know, even if it's just what's the call to action, you know, changing a button from blue to green, moving a call to action, you know, changing it from or testing to see whether call us versus call now is going to be more effective. And we find that there are significant gains when you do that. You know, we change certain calls to action on a website. For example, I think we went from schedule an appointment to schedule your appointment for some of our clients. And we saw a 27% increase in the number of people who clicked that button without any additional paid traffic, without any additional. And it's just literally you change one word on a call to action, the market reacts. I can tell you that marketing is as much science as it is kind of art and creativity. And in fact, maybe even more so. And so kind of having this commitment to testing every single one of your marketing assets. And when I talk about marketing assets, what are the kinds of things you can test? Well, you can test your website flow. You can test the videos that you're using and where you're using videos. By the way, there are certain pages on websites. When we put a video on that, we see conversion rates go up substantially. You can test the way your website forms work. You can test the emails that you send to people as a confirmation of whether it's an appointment or a demo or an interest, the way you present your brand, the type of content that you have, the offers that you make, every single thing you go to market with, just have two versions. Literally A and B, and test A and B and see which one does better. And then as soon as you've got a winner, test that winner against something else, see what you learn. And it's just kind of like that mindset shift that it should not be static, it should not be stagnant, and you should always be testing. That's a really big deal. And you know, we also talk about that, not just in the marketing standpoint, we also talk about that inside of the business operations. So, you know, when we think about consumer or our clients who may have a, you know, physical space, physical business where they provide services, we talk about testing the greeting, for example, procedure explanations, the way they present the order of the things that they're selling, the phone scripting, you know, even your on-hold messaging, your signage, your referral programs, the way you present kind of how someone has to pay for something. Each one of those things can have an A/B test associated with it. And, you know, we find that it's ridiculous how much more from a results standpoint, how much more you can get from it. I have a funny side story that, you know, one of my marketing mentors, Jay Abraham has kind of written about, I think, in the past, is that he had a client who was a furniture store. It was a large furniture store, and they tested, I guess he convinced them to test the greeting, and they tested a bunch of different greetings. And if you had to guess, MC, if you just had to guess out of nowhere, like, what's the top greeting when you walk into a furniture store, right? You've probably had this experience. You walk into a furniture store and there's a sales guy who's sitting right there, and all you're trying to do is just like duck and shield and, you know, like not be accosted by the sales guy, but he's going to say something to you anyway, right? So what's the one greeting that outperformed all of the other ones and led to more sales? What would you guess?
Oh, wow. It's not going to be howdy.
No, it's not.
It might also not be how can I help you or why did you come in today?
No.
I want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors. My friend Dave Zook says, you can be conventional or you can be wealthy. Pick one. At The Real Asset Investor, Dave and his team bring their investors high-yield investment opportunities across several asset classes for cash flow, tax impact, and equity growth. He and his team are one of the top 5 ATM operators in the country, and they have an investment opportunity available to accredited investors right now in the ATM space. To learn more about their ATM funds that produce tax-free cash flow, visit therealassetinvestor.com.
What's interesting, and again, I've had crowds, large audiences guess, and I love this example because it just, again, represents how much you can learn from just letting the market tell you what's going on. And that greeting, by the way, the one that outperformed all other ones was, "And what ad brought you in the store today?"
Wow.
And, you know, like you can make up a lot of great reasons why. I'm sure because if you didn't bring in with an ad, then you could start a conversation with like, oh, would you like to look at our ads? You know, would you like to see what's on sale? You know, maybe the other thing is like, oh, well, you know, I saw this. Okay, great. Well, let me show you the part that's, let me be helpful and show you the things that are on sale. Whatever that is, it doesn't really matter because the market told this particular furniture store at that particular moment in time, what's the best way to do that. You know, I know Google reviews are really important to a lot of our clients to a lot of businesses. And so we've been testing, right? And there's and what you test is how often do you ask for a Google review, or how far after somebody's done business with you do you ask for a Google review? What do you actually say in a text message when you have a Google review? And what's interesting, MC, is that, you know, for many of our medical clients, what you actually say has evolved. Like what generates the most number of reviews has actually evolved over time. You know, we at around this time last year, and in fact, with the spike of Omicron at some point, we actually found that a cleanliness and, you know, your health and well-being is really important to us. Please give us your feedback was like the best way to ask for a review. In today's environment, it's a completely different story. It's a, you know, may I ask you a question with a question mark, an exclamation point or something like that. Like, and all you do is you just continuously test, and it really doesn't matter even what it is today, as long as you commit, which is that second pillar, as long as you commit to this discipline of constantly testing what you're doing on a regular basis. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And just, you know, in this environment where there's a lot of challenges and problems that are people going to have, because they do in economies that are bad, it's just so interesting to, and I talk about it a lot too, just with folks on my team to see what message resonates best, because people think in narratives. And narratives continually change. It's the same problem.
Yes.
The narratives around it has changed. So you have to stay relevant, and you have to see what the best messaging is, right?
Well, to that point, and this is where, you know, you're kind of leading right into the third pillar. So for those keeping track, number one is grab share of voice. Number two is test everything. Number three is what we call value innovation. Now, value innovation is not really doing something completely different or innovating, creating something completely new. It's taking something that you're already doing and positioning it as a solution to a consumer who is less economically confident at this time in the world. And I'll give you a perfect example. You know, 2008, 2009 recession, we were talking about, you know, a lot of businesses took that opportunity as a, or took that time as an opportunity. One business that did that was Amazon. And, you know, while almost every other business lost 30 to 50% of its market value during the 2008-2009 recession, Amazon's profits went up by 68%. And one of the ways in which they did that was relatively clever. It was they looked at the marketplace and said, well, people are going to buy fewer things. So we have to make things feel more affordable to our consumers. So this is where they reintroduced. Now, mind you, they already had this on the market and they reintroduced it. The Kindle had been around. It just wasn't selling. Nobody really cared. Nobody wanted to read books on a digital device. Yep. But they reintroduced it and said, you know what, MC, you have fewer dollars in your pocket. And to help you, out of the goodness of our heart, we're giving you this device where you can spend less money on digital books. And you can have it, you know, in the palm of your hand with this convenient device. And it worked. It worked because it was a solution to a problem that the market already had. And they basically took it. And this is where I call value innovation. They repositioned it as a solution to that marketplace issue. And so I think the outcome was that in the Christmas season of 2009, more digital books were sold than physical books on Amazon for the first time ever. And it was because of this concept of value innovation. And so, again, it kind of positions this whole idea of doing what you've always done doesn't necessarily work in a marketplace, but adjusting it to, you know, the marketplace's needs and kind of positioning it as a solution to the needs of the marketplace is really kind of the goal here. You know, another big business that lost a ton of money in the 2008-2009 recession is Blockbuster, right? They this was like the beginning of their giant decline. At its peak, I think they had close to like 85,000 employees. And in the recession of 2008-2009, they lost close to like $370 million or something ridiculous like that. And they started posting losses. And one company that was innovative at the time and already offered the service, but kind of stepped up their marketing and said, we're more of a solution, was Netflix. Yep. And you know, it's not the Netflix you're thinking of today, where all the streaming, if you remember, and I kind of have this vivid image in my head of their like initial, you know, kind of like website with frames, and you'd like, you pick your DVDs that are going to be mailed to you at the rapid speed of the donkey mule at the US post office. and then you're going to be receiving those DVDs, and then you're going to watch them maybe next weekend and the weekend after and whatever. And then you're going to be mailing them back at the rapid speed of that same mule to Netflix headquarters. And then they're going to be sending you the next one when they receive it back. In the end, most people spent more money per DVD watched than they would have spent at Blockbuster. But this was positioned as a solution, as a subscription service solution that was a value innovation in a time of economic uncertainty. And people jumped on board, and it really fueled and grow helped grow Netflix to the point, I think they had like at the same time that Netflix or that Blockbuster lost that $370 million, Netflix grew by, I think, 24% at that time. So, you know, this was a big deal. And this is a perfect example of value innovation. And I think people can do this in their business. They can think about, you know, the way that they position, again, the way that you ask people to pay for the product that you have. You can think about contests, raffles, product launches, special events, last year's pricing. You know, this is one example I use a lot with my clients is that, well, have you raised prices this year? No. Okay, perfect. We're going to value innovate and say last year's pricing is available for a very limited time. That's a value innovation in itself, because that's a solution for an economically uncertain consumer where they're expecting prices to go up. So if you haven't raised prices, last year's pricing or 2019 pricing, if you haven't raised prices since 2019 pricing is available for a limited time. That's a value innovation, right? Examples of that, you know, just kind of, again, stuff you may already be doing. They're just positioned in a way that looks more like a solution. You know, we have clients that, you know, sell a $4,800 procedure for LASIK surgery, for example. And we said, do you offer financing? And they said, of course, you know, we of course offer financing. Well, now we're thinking about communicating to the consumer rather than saying, oh, okay, it's, you know, $4,800 and now it's, and financing is available. Why don't we start with it's $99 per eye per month? Because now you're solving again a problem of I'm trying to budget this month and can I afford this as opposed to something else. So, but they didn't have to go out and get a new financing partner. They already offered this. It's just positioning it for the consumer at a time that in a way that's really relevant. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love how, you know, the Netflix story. I love how the solution was so elegant, because I remember, and I mean, younger listeners and viewers might not remember this, but Blockbuster even had like a loyalty program, right? Where you would rent like 10 videos and then, you know, you get one free. And then Netflix just came in because they understood they were looking at the environment with this elegant solution where it's like, you just go on your computer, you place your order and they mail out your DVDs. It's very simple, very user-friendly, right?
Exactly.
And eventually to transition to now you just, you know, pay the same amount essentially that you pay per month, getting those 5 DVDs or something like that. But now it's unlimited streaming. Straight into your home. So they just kept building and innovating, you know, that elegant solution. And now even, you know, if you look at the environment that they're operating in the world of streaming, there's a lot of streaming wars going on, and they still are up there with all of the other big companies, right? Amazon and Apple's got a streaming service, and Disney, and, you know, Hulu. It's quite crazy.
But you think about the fact that a recessionary environment caused someone to make an innovation that ultimately really jump-started their growth and success at a level that, you know, has made them into a household name in today's environment. But it was that recession of 2008, 2009, and the innovation that they had during that recession that really made Netflix one of the greatest companies today.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that by understanding their environment, the sharing economy exploded during the last one, right? The Airbnbs, the Ubers and Lyfts.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, so, you know, and this is kind of where we go from understanding your environment standpoint. This is also a good opportunity to think about, and this is kind of my growth key number 4, is really staying up on your competition. So this is a time when we talk about you can't afford to squander opportunity. You know, when I think about it, like, and I always compare it to like the in the sports world, when you have like a really big game, right? Like an NBA finals game, how many hours of video versus how many hours of playtime is an actual player involved in? Like, how much time is a typical player spending watching video and preparing and studying their competition and seeing how this guy typically moves or whatever, so that they can be prepared for the game? And I can tell you, MC, that on average, it's certainly a lot more time that they spend studying the competition than actually playing the game, right? But it's like 100-1 for some of the bigger games. It's like 100 hours of video for every hour of game time. And I'm not saying that you need to go, you know, invest the entirety of your day in just looking at what your competitors are doing. But what I can tell you is, in today's digital environment, you have tools that I didn't have back in 2008, 2009. I'm actually really excited because at this time, in 2022, in this recessionary environment, what we have are, you know, easy ways to track what the competition is doing in mass, right? So all of our clients, we're looking at the competitors in their geographies or in their particular fields, and we've got loggers set up on their websites to see if a competitor makes a change on a website, we'll get notified. Maybe they added a new, line of service. Maybe they added some new technology. We want to know about that before, you know, so that our client can be aware of it. We subscribe to our competitors, to our clients' competitors' mailing lists, right? Like their email, their, you know, their social media, all of that type of stuff. We see our clients' competitors' sales and promos, their social media. These are tools that you have today that you didn't have before. So if you think about who are the competitors that you really want to grab market share from, and sometimes those are the big corporates, and sometimes those are just, you know, people in the in your immediate geography, or some people who are in your field. However that works, it just, you know, their marketing is public. Just subscribe to it. You know, it's like it's easier than ever to do that. And there are some advanced tools that you can use for, you know, logging people's website or to kind of keep track of changes on other people's websites. You can do some Googling around that. But we definitely have seen a bunch of we've definitely been able to see how to be proactive based off of, you know, when a competitor shifts, you can shift much quicker today than you could, you know, 10 years ago. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And great point. I mean, yeah, it's you have access to all of these things online now and tools, like you said, that weren't available for a long time. So, yeah, very, very easy to stay up to date of what's going on exactly in your niche with regarding your competition. I want to recognize one of our sponsors, Penumbra Solutions. Life settlement investments have allowed financial and banking institutions to not only buy their equity contractually, but also diversify their capital from any economic, market, and geopolitical risk. It's been part of the billion-dollar blueprint followed by institutional investors. And if you're an accredited investor, you can also now participate in this vehicle with enormous growth potential. You can watch an informational webinar presented by one of the premier organizations providing life settlement investments, Penumbra Solutions, at cashflowninja.com/life settlements. That's cashflowninja.com/life settlements.
And the last point, you know, and again, that if you're keeping track, you know, we've talked about value innovation. We've talked about grabbing share of voice. We've talked about testing. We've talked about looking at the competition. And the fifth one that really pulls it together is what we call perpetual distinction. This is a time to decommoditize your business. And when I talked about strategy in the beginning, kind of identifying leverage points, let's identify what makes you unique from the perspective of your buyer, from the perspective of your consumer. And, you know, and the standard argument of, you know, sale or quality and service and that kind of stuff, it's not going to work. Let's just kind of set that aside. I don't care how good you think your customer service is. I don't care how good you think your product is. It's just not going to work because everybody expects quality. Everybody expects good service. Nobody goes to market saying, "Yeah, you know, like we're kind of rude to you, and we're sort of mean, and you know, we don't really answer our phones, and you know, and our product is pretty subpar, but you should pay us money, right?" Like nobody does that. Everybody says we have the best quality, we have the best service. So set that aside, and now really think about what is it that makes you unique in the eyes of your consumer? What is it that you can do better in the eyes of your consumer? And then from the perspective of your buyer, really do, I would encourage people, and I've done this in seminars, and I've also done this when I've had large speaking engagements, but I've also done this, you know, in executive sessions for clients where their leadership team is challenged to write down kind of three things. What do we do better from the perspective of our consumer? Why does it matter from the perspective of our consumer? And then how do we justify that we actually do this? How can we explain that? What do we have that's unique that allows us to do this? So for example, if you're saying that you have the most thorough and detailed service, well, why does it matter? Well, because it delivers a thorough and detailed analysis, for example, that you provide in whatever industry that you have. Well, why does it matter from the perspective of consumer? Because 90% of other services leave, you know, we don't look at this particular area. You know, this will give you peace of mind because we've actually looked at this particular piece of information. And then how do we do this? Well, maybe we have some proprietary software that we wrote. Maybe we invested in some technology. Maybe we have 10 quants on the team who are able to do this analysis in a way that other people can't. You know, like whatever all of that looks like, you know, tell a compelling story, and we call that perpetual distinction, and identify 4 to 6 different leverage points that from the perspective of the buyer can help create this perpetual distinction. Why are you not a commodity? Why are you not like everybody else? And if you can position that, if you can go through that process in your own mind as a business owner, and then go through it with your leadership team, and then get everybody on your team bought into this at this particular time, you'll see your organization start to transform into an organization that really starts living those distinctions and serving the consumer in a way that's, you know, really does help decommoditize you in their mind, which then breeds consumer loyalty. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I love these five pillars of growth in a recession. Our listeners can listen to this over and over. Repetition is how we learn, but grabbing share of voice, test everything, value innovation, studying the competition, and perpetual distinction. Absolutely powerful stuff here to grow your business in a recession. Eugene, one of the habits of that I've observed of wealthy and successful people is that they're always studying, they're always learning. What are you currently studying and learning?
You know, I have like six or seven books open that are, you know, all about different consumer behavior things. But one of the things that I realized as I'm thinking about this question is that the thing that I'm always looking for is the articles that talk to me about how the consumer is behaving in today's environment. You know, it's like a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. You know, my clients are successful when consumers behave in a specific way that ultimately leads to my clients being able to capitalize on that behavior. So I'm always fascinated with anything at all that has that has value in explaining what consumer behavior looks like. Whether those, you know, then that's what I'm when I'm looking at. You know, when I pop open my Wall Street Journal app every single morning, I realize that the articles I gravitate towards aren't necessarily, you know, the politics or whatever, but it's really anything that kind of helps get inside the mind of the consumer and tells you here is what the consumer is thinking today. And or here's some insights into what a typical consumer's mindset is in today's environment.
Right. Now, we talk a lot about business, investing, cash flow on the show, but a big part of it is also legacy and just passing on principles and values to future generations. Now, if you cannot pass on any money or capital to future generations, but we're only allowed to pass on three principles to them, to build wealth and achieve happiness and success, what would they be?
You know, I struggle with this question a little bit, MC, because there's four that I would pass on. But if you hammer me down to three, do you want me to do four or you want me to do three?
Four is perfect.
Okay, I'll go with four then. And this is actually the way we run our company too. We challenge every single person to think about this on a quarterly basis. We also, when we interview people, when we hire people, when we think about, you know, promoting people, we really focus in on these four principles because we think that skill set is something you can learn. Mindset is something that's really difficult to change. So I have four mindset kind of things that we live by in our organization. I firmly believe in these personally as well. And the first one is deep interest and constant curiosity. So that's the ability to ask good questions, being excited to learn from others, being interested in the data and the science of what you're kind of learning and working from. Just always being a student of life, right? That's a really big thing. And, you know, and I try to teach my daughter the same thing. I'm always trying to broaden her mind but, you know, at the same time, that also means being willing to teach, you know, being using our knowledge to be trusted advisors and then finding understanding what, you know, what the market needs at a deeper level and being able to, you know, bring that to the surface. So deep interest and constant curiosity is number one. Number two is I believe that, you know, we are not silos. People are not siloed. We're social beings. And so collaboration and identifying other people's strengths is so critical. So the second one is collaboration with empathy. And with empathy is really like that piece that says like the no jerks rule. Like I don't really want a lot of jerks in my life. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think I should be forced to collaborate with people who don't necessarily see eye to eye with me on that last point. But I think that, you know, you approach every problem with a solution-focused mindset. You think about how we make others feel and see what we can give first before we ask. And we treat all of our collaborators as really partners, you know, and be inclusive with the world that we have. And we treat our work with humility. We treat our clients with humility. We treat our family with humility. And I think that also comes with the mindset that you're not afraid to say, I don't know, and ask for help. Because when you say, I need help, there'll be a lot of people stand up to help you. If you pretend that you know everything, you know, it doesn't really work that way. Number three is client-focused value creation. So we, and I think about this as in work, it's client focused value creation. But it really in the world, it's value creation in general. It's like, think about what you do, take pride in it, really care about the impact that it has on others, you know, rather than just, hey, I did my thing and now we can, and now I can go home, or I did my thing because so and so asked me. It's like, well, what value am I trying to create? And how can I go just a little bit further and make sure that I can find that? And the fourth one for me is building a better future. It's always treating my, many of my relationships, many of my everything that I do in business, you know, just kind of recognize that we should be working together to build a better future. You know, it's really much more of a longer term investor route than it is like a get in, get out. You know, I know that you have a lot of real estate experience, and you know, I'm always the guy buy and hold on the real estate rather than the buy and flip on the real estate. Not that there's anything wrong with the buy and flip, but you know, when I approach kind of my life with this mindset of building a better future, for me, more than anything, it means that you're going to invest an hour today to save 100 hours tomorrow, that you're always encouraging people around you to see a picture that's bigger, brighter, and better than the one that you have today. And you're trying to involve people and lead people to collaborate with you to get there. So those are my four core mindsets that I think that I'd love to share with people.
Fantastic. This has been an absolute blast. Who are some of the clients that you work with, just so that our listeners and our viewers would know, specifically who are the people that you're serving and that you're helping, and how can folks follow you and your company and stay in touch of all of the many projects and opportunities that you're involved with?
Yeah, I mean, anyone with a practice-based business, what that typically means is medical, you know, lawyers, but anyone with a practice-based business is really kind of our bread and butter. And for the most part on the medical side, you know, we think about anyone within the elective medical space. So anytime, you know, I'm going to go see my primary care physician for a physical, I'm going to whip out my insurance card and pay a $20 copay. That's not really, you know, you don't need a lot of marketing for that. You just need to be on the right insurance panels. But anytime that you're thinking about having some sort of, anytime you need someone to dig deep into their pocket and pull out some money, there's a decision-making process that happens at that moment. And so if you're in a business where you're kind of in that, you're in the business of compelling people to reach deep into their pockets and pick you over somebody else, or pick your practice over somebody else's practice, or, you know, believe that the outcome, and sometimes it's a high stakes outcome in the medical field, you know, getting the wrong surgeon could be a really, really high stakes decision. And yep. So communicating that and communicating the value of picking you versus your competition, that's really what we do. And then also now, obviously, staying up on the latest trends. We have a research team that consistently stays up on the latest and greatest trends related to anything with digital marketing, anything with practice growth strategy, and that kind of thing. So, you know, that's who we work with. You know, our website is nationalstrategic.com. I think MC, for your listeners, what we'll probably do, and I mentioned this as a value innovation of ours, is that we do an analysis for people of their marketing. It costs anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 to do that analysis for people who, you know, and I'm sure that you will have some sort of link that that you can share with your audience. But anybody who wants an analysis done on their digital marketing and kind of fits into the criteria of the businesses that we serve, they can request that analysis, and it's, you know, 30 to 50 hours worth of work. We'll do that for them either for free or at a substantial discount, depending on their business type you know, some of the hard costs associated with that research. But I think that that's kind of my value innovation that I want to bring to the marketplace, because in all reality, we all at this point need to collaborate to make sure that we're all taking advantage of the opportunities that are presented to us at a time of economic distress.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate that. That link would be at cashflowninja.com/NSG. NSG. That's cashflowninja.com/NSG.
Oh, for National Strategic Group. Yeah, great.
Yep. Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your journey and your knowledge and just providing so much value for all of my listeners and viewers out there.
It's an absolute pleasure, MC. I'm happy to be a resource, and I'm proud to partner with you.
Absolutely. And thank you to our listeners and our viewers for spending your most valuable resource, your time, once again with me on the show. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at cashflowninja.com. You could sign up for our newsletter at cashflowninja.com/subscribe. Until next time, live infinitely. This presentation is for educational and informational purposes only. The information being presented and considered does not consider your particular financial objectives or situation, and it does not make personalized recommendations. This material is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified tax and legal advisor or other qualified professionals, and you should not use the information in place of a customized consultation with a licensed professional regarding your specific personal financial objectives, situation and needs. We believe the information provided is reliable, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, timeliness, or completeness.